Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. Sorry about my voice today. These allergies are killing me. So today we are going to talk about the couple things. We have Tom Philpott on the line with us. Tom is one of my absolute all-time favorite guests and certainly my favorite journalist. He is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones and the co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Cruces, North Carolina. He was formerly a columnist and editor for the online environmental site Grist, and his work on food politics has appeared in Newsweek, Gastronomica, and The Guardian. Welcome, Tom. How are you?
Good, Katie. How are you doing?
Good. Great. I am suffering from my weekend warrior status as a gardener, where I go out to my place in Rhode Island and work the soil for, 8 hours at a stretch. And then I wonder nice. Why my hands won't work at the end of the day. It's painful. But anyway, so you were in New York last week. I missed you because I missed the whole edible communities event. But give us a quick recap, because that was quite the event. It got lots of nice press in the progressive papers, and it had some great looking panels on it. And you were on one of the panels at least. What were you doing?
I was there. I was on a journalism panel with Sam Fromart.
Oh, yeah. Love Sam.
Elizabeth Royd is a fantastic
freelance writer.
She's awesome.
She's been a guest. Yeah, I've had her on a couple times.
And an editor from Harper's who kind of does their food coverage. I'm forgetting his name, but he was cool. And it was great. And the editor of Edible Manhattan, his name is also escaping me, but it was a lot of fun. And in addition to that, Mark Bittman gave kind of a rousing keynote. Uh-huh. Anna LaPay also gave a keynote as well. That was
She's
really
great.
Good.
Yeah.
And Paul Greenberg, who's a fantastic writer on fishery.
Yeah, love him.
Did a really cool panel where he got some fishermen up there and talked about some of the issues facing fisheries and the whole paradox of our, U.S. seafood. Basically we import 90% of the seafood that we eat, and yet we export a third of our wild catch. So most of what we're importing is pretty low quality farm stuff from places like Southeast Asia and South America.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we're catching some pretty fantastic fish and sending it off.
Is the reason we're sending it off because we're just not used to eating those particular types of fish? Are these unusual fish for the American palate?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think we've gotten used to, your sort of red lobster, Long John Silver's kind of seafood, which is a real commodity when it's sort of prepared and cooked in that way, kind of standardized. And it's really easy for those big companies to substitute into, the very cheapest products possible.
Sure.
And other places have more of a relationship with, sort of relationship with quality seafood, and so that they're willing to pay up for our wild catch. It's funny, our fisheries as fisheries aren't really managed that badly, compared to other places in the world.
Yeah.
Most of what we're doing to our fisheries comes from pollution and, ecological degradation.
Right.
So we have pretty robust fisheries in some ways, but most of the catch is leaving the country, or, a huge portion of the catch, I should say, not most.
Right. No, I've done quite a lot of reading around seafood because I've written a couple articles for Food Arts about the fishing industry. So I got a bird's eye view of the catch share program and got really down into that with fishermen and also with National Marine Fisheries Services and stuff. So, I find the whole seafood thing fascinating, actually, because it is – It is a little bit of, despite the catch share program, it's definitely internationally, it's kind of the Wild West. And one thing is like, when I don't know if I told you I was going to Vietnam this spring.
No.
Well, you can imagine that I had a field day looking at the agricultural products there. And not that I had anything particularly organized about it, but when you're out in the country, which I was for much of the time, you're walking around and it's basically, it's an agrarian society. So there's a lot of livestock to look at, and there are a lot of little fish farms, which I just found fascinating. And, you know, they were not exactly designed to, not to diss my Vietnamese friends, but they were not designed to make me feel comfortable about eating farmed fish, let me tell you.
No.
I mean, those were some little tiny pools, basically, that were pretty murky. Like, I couldn't really see through the water, you know, and I asking my guide questions about it, I was like, well, how do they clean out those little tiny pools that they're in? Well, I don't think they do, he says to me. Great.
And, you know, unfortunately, I've done some reporting on the FDAs and the way that it oversees imports of that exact kind of seafood.
Right.
And it's pretty minimalist, you know, they test less than 1%. And, when, you know, activists, kind of watchdog groups have performed tests themselves, they find that, you know, they found stuff like banned pesticides, banned antibiotics.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like,
I mean, walking through the fields or walking through the countryside, you saw people with tanks on their backs hosing down the crops with pesticides, you know,
right.
I mean, like, and then bags of nitrogen fertilizer just left by the road, you know, like for somebody to shovel out onto the paddies or whatever. I mean, it was, you know, it was pretty, it's tough, very tough life, pretty hard conditions. To farm in, and they're using every means they can to boost their crop yields, obviously, and they don't have a lot of information about what is and is not safe to eat, obviously. So, but anyway, it sounds like a great panel. I know that people can find out more about it on various websites. I know Civil Eats did some stuff. Grist also, I'm sure the Edible website is full of information, and I know you can listen to a lot of the panels.
In fact, you can watch, I think there's video uploaded of all the panels on the Edible website.
Mm-hmm. I got to go
there. I highly recommend the Paul Greenberg one.
Yeah, Paul's been a guest on this show a couple of times, and he is, without a doubt, one of my favorites. I mean, he's just so articulate, so knowledgeable, and he's such a great guy. But anyway.
Yeah, super
kind of like you.
As well.
Kind of like Tom. It's one of the reasons I like you. You're just a great guy. So anyway, Tom, let us, without further ado, talk about the National Climate Assessment Report that came out about 2 weeks ago. And has really got everybody wagging their fingers and and saying, well, I told you so, or at least, you know, in my group. It was a pretty shocking, pretty terrifying report. But who was responsible for it? It was like a bilateral, multi-country. Who was involved in this?
This particular one was the U.S. one.
Because it's the U.S. National Climate Report. Yeah, so who are the...
The federal agencies that would have anything to do with climate change. So, you know, EPA, USDA, NOAA, you know, the National...
Oceanic Atmospheric Administration.
Whatever that thing is called.
Yeah.
So it's all these different agencies coming together, and, you know, different agencies took control of different parts of it. So obviously USDA oversaw the agriculture part. And I don't really think it taught us anything new that wasn't already out there. Because, you know, what it's basically doing is collating and gathering together all of the recent studies that people like you and me kind of follow as they come out.
Right.
But, you know, it is, you know, it's sort of assessing them and kind of giving us the state of science. This is what the best science is telling us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think the fact that it is this sort of government, and then they also, the contractor was out with outside non-governmental researchers, but, you know, very highly respected ones, very mainstream ones. And, you know, I would say, given that it's, you know, these government agencies, if anything, it's giving us the median to probably kind of best case scenario. It's not, you know, it's not anything on the alarmist end. You know, it's pretty unassailable in terms of, you know, activists are, have taken control and are, you know, tweaking the information. You know, this is a very cautious approach.
Huh.
And, you know, especially given that, it's pretty concerning.
I found it terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, you put out that article in Mother Jones that was like seven graphs or, you know, seven ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my blood sort of went cold when I looked at that. It was pretty scary stuff. What do you think were the key points then? So, like, you know, there seemed to be like areas of concern. There's the soil erosion that's taking place because of heavy rains. Then there's the extreme drought in California and the Southwest. You know, there's the closing in of our shorelines, the rise in oceanic waters. What else were the big points to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think about the basic kind of calculus of the next, let's say 30 or 40 years, we know that the population is going to grow by about 50% over the current level. I think, you know, the basic UN consensus is that we're going from about 6 billion to about 9 billion people.
Right.
And so, you know, something's got to give in food and ag systems. And one thing that this report is showing us, and, you know, the United States is, you know, obviously a key linchpin in the global food system.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as a temperate country, it's got some of the greatest soil resources in the world. You know, it's got a good climate for growing. You know, it's obviously a powerhouse. This is one of the key nodes of the global
food
chain.
Absolutely.
And what it's telling us is that it's going to be really, really hard to, you know, if present trends continue and things continue as they are, it's going to be really, really hard to actually grow much more food on the land here in the United States. You know, because, you know, basically what the sort of climate skeptics have been saying for a while now is, you know, even if you're right that we're putting all this carbon in the atmosphere and atmospheric carbon is growing, that's going to be good for food production because plants need CO2 and it's going to stimulate plant growth. And isn't that great? Well, this is a definitive riposte to that, that other things like heat stress, like drought stress, like soil erosion are going to make it really, really hard. It's basically going to offset the effect of increased CO2.
Right, by quite a bit. That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah, by quite a bit. And then another thing that's disturbing about it is that whereas crops evolved in a very specific set of circumstances, and the crops that were growing, let's say in the Midwest, they were developed and they evolved in a century that had a pretty stable climate, and you know, one that doesn't exist anymore, and crops are a lot more fragile, they're a lot more dependent on things like that. On sort of stable conditions, and there's another kind of plant that is much more versatile. That's much, you know, adapts a lot faster, and that's weeds. And, weeds. There are certain weeds that appear as though they are going to benefit from this extra CO2.
Mm-hmm.
And are going to be able to adjust to the higher temperatures in a way that crops aren't.
Sure.
So we're going to probably see more weed pressure. And one thing that I think that was kind of buried in the report a little bit, I mean, it's a vast report, so I'm not criticizing it. In fact, it was there in black and white, and I missed it the first go around, but I did something on it a week later. One thing that's in there is that, and I had never heard this before, but apparently glyphosate doesn't work well for weeds that are sort of supercharged with CO2. So as weeds take in more CO2 and adjust to this new climate, glyphosate is going to lose effectiveness even more.
Uh-huh.
And as most of your listeners probably already know by now, it's already losing effectiveness because of overuse. but it's going to be yet another downward pressure on glyphosate, making it less effective and making farmers either use higher doses of it or revert to older, more toxic.
Well, which they are doing now. I mean, they're using that 2D4, I think it's called, and that just got
2,4-D,
FDA.
2,4-D,
thank
right.
you. And that just got some kind of an approval that it had not had before, even though they've used it for years. But that was that's one of the components of Agent Orange, as everyone is very quick to point out. So... You know, this is already happening. The glyphosate is being phased out.
That's right.
And other herbicides are being phased in. To what end, we don't know in terms of what they will do to soil management and water tables and so on.
That's right.
I wanted to just go back for just a second to talk about the Farm Bill, because the Farm Bill was pretty much business as usual in terms of, the big crop insurance programs for commodity crops like corn, soy, rice, cotton, et cetera. Not a lot, has changed in the Farm Bill. And they ended up signing the Farm Bill or finishing the Farm Bill before this climate assessment came out, which says essentially that the crops that we grow as commodity crops are not going to be as successful in coming years as they have been now, which I think drastically changes the picture for the Farm Bill. And yet we're stuck with this now for 5 years. What do you think is going to, what do you think the outcome of that is going to be?
Well, I mean, I think that, the Farm Bill, very, very few of the key challenges facing agriculture come up in the Farm Bill debate ever, the way that it is right
That's
now.
True. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 2014 Farm Bill that just got signed, I guess early in January, I mean, if you think about what was going on, I mean, none of the stuff that came out in this report was, like I said, none of it was new information. Any policymaker, any USDA official already kind of knew this stuff. Anyone on the Hill who cared to look knew this stuff. And you know that we're moving rapidly into climate change. We've already seen, in the last 4 or 5 years, incessantly chaotic weather in the Midwest.
Yeah.
We've had, we had the biggest drought ever in 2012.
The tornadoes.
The wettest spring ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wettest spring ever in the Midwest in 2013. 2008, we saw huge, massive flooding and loss of soil in the Midwest. These issues are out there. And, in the Farm Bill, the basic debate was over, how much to cut food stamps. That's what that's what held it up. There were some mini battles between the different commodities, cotton and corn and peanuts all had little skirmishes, but the main gist of the debate was about how much are we going to cut food stamps at a time of growing poverty, which is pathetic in and of itself. But then when you think about the challenges facing agriculture, and this is our agriculture policy, it's completely disconnected from that. And frankly, this report could have come out in the middle of that debate, and it wouldn't have changed it an iota. And, it's basically that, the agri business controls that debate. In terms of farm policy, in terms of, how we should run farm policy, there is no real debate going on.
No, there's no debate, but there's also no acknowledgement of climate change. And that's what I think is so astonishing about this. It's like even the big players who stand to lose their shirts if they don't make some accommodation and start recognizing and making adaptations to status quo, they're going to lose their shirts. That's what I find so astonishing about it.
I was just going to say, if you're selling seeds, if you're selling pesticides and fertilizers and things like that, there is loads and loads of money to be made between now and some point of no return it sounds very cynical, but that's what it seems like is going on. Like they really just don't care because, they are going to make lots of money in the next quarter. And, in a situation where I remember in 2008 when there was all that flooding, there was this massive washing away of fertilizers and herbicides.
Yeah.
And the answer was to replant and reapply. So you got, if you were
rinse and
one
repeat.
Of those companies, all that is, for, you know, that's actually kind of great news. You're getting this, you know, boost in sales. And if, you know, if glyphosate loses effectiveness, well, we've got this other one, like you said, 2,4-D or Dicombo, which is another kind of bad old one.
Right.
That can come in, and that's kind of where we are with that.
Amazing. Tom, we're going to take a short break now for a sponsor drop. Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott talking about agriculture and climate change.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm talking today with Tom Philpott, who is the food and ag correspondent for Mother Jones. He's written a lot about the climate change assessment report that came out a couple of weeks ago. So we're dissecting it point by point. Tom, I want to talk for a minute about long-term food security. For example, when we talk about drought in California, and I did a show a couple weeks ago with the NRDC about drought in California and water protection, water solutions, what are we going to do when California runs out of water? I mean, that's our breadbasket.
One hopes that we make some smarter decisions before that happens. Currently... You know, they've got this incredible infrastructure built up to get water, basically snow melt from the Sierra Nevada mountains to farms. And the snow melt is likely to decrease.
Yeah.
The amount of snow that gets packed into those mountains is likely to decrease over the years. And I talked to a scientist at Berkeley a while back who looked at the fossil record. And she thinks that even taking climate change off the table, the 20th century was a very wet century for California. It's wettest in, you know, many millennia.
Really?
And she thinks that it's going to revert to mean and be more like, you know, previous centuries coming up really soon, maybe right now. And so she thinks that California can expect about 15% less water if that would be the reversion to mean, like the more normal situation. Then when you add climate change into it, what she says is that you're shifting from you're going to get less snow and more rain, and less snow is bad because when it snows, it holds there
right
all winter and then it releases in the spring, whereas rain is a whole lot harder to capture.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the way it works in California, where you get rain only in very certain seasons.
That's right.
And so that's all that is bad news. But at the same time, you're still going to have snow melt. You're still going to have this resource, and you still have infrastructure built up over years, you know, billions of dollars of investments in it. And that resource could be used a lot smarter. I think, you know, basically figuring out the crops that we really need, focusing on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one thing that we're seeing this huge shift in the Central Valley of California to nut crops. And nut crops are good in some ways, and they're this great source of protein, other health, and great high-quality fat. Agriculturally, they should be limited there because when you have a drought in California, when you get a dry year,
yeah.
If you got annual crops in, you can simply fallow the crop that year,
right?
And then you know, forget about it, and then plant it the next year when you get more snowmelt. If you've got a bunch of nuts, you got to keep those trees alive,
yeah.
And you've got to water them rain or shine. You got to water them right. No matter what,
and that means irrigation.
And so what you get is what's happening right now, which I've written about. And that is this frenzy of water pumping. And this is where we get to your to your question, what happens when California runs out of water? Mm-hmm. The Central Valley is sitting on this fossil water supply, this underground, they call it groundwater. And not groundwater, it's now I'm getting my my terms mixed up.
It's not an aquifer?
It is groundwater, because there's surface water and groundwater, so it's called groundwater. It's underground.
Right.
And they're pumping the hell out of it right now.
Yeah.
They're basically acting as if there isn't a drought, and they fallowed a little bit of land, but not very much. And we're getting this boom in nuts, and so nuts are expanding, and this need for water is expanding. And so if current trends continue, then your question becomes very relevant. Like, what happens when the last suck of the straw, and, you know, basically, you know, as the water table drops, pumping gets more expensive, more energy intensive, and we're already seeing that. There's no doubt right now that it's being pumped many times faster than it's being recharged.
Right.
And so the big challenge out there is to, you know, you think of a new way of doing things that doesn't rely on massive extractions of groundwater during dry times. And, you know, one of the problems there is regulation. There's essentially no regulation of groundwater pumping.
Uh-huh, yes.
If you own the land, you can drop a straw and suck all the water that you want.
And that's happening. And, I mean, big companies are buying water. They're buying land just for the water rights in the Midwest and Colorado.
The water rights.
Yeah.
And they're also doing insane things. Like, there's parts of the Central Valley that have been grassland for cows for years and years and years and years. You know, sometimes more than 100 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, cow production is something that, you know, you can cull the herd if you don't have enough pasture.
Mm-hmm.
You can grow the herd when you do. And it's if it's done right, it's relatively low impact. And they're taking rangeland and literally putting in stands of nut trees. And so you're going from a kind of agriculture that is that varies with rain levels to one that needs water year after year after year. And that's just insane.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got to come up with some regulations that stop those kind of land use changes.
Yeah, that seems like a, you know, a ticket to a ticket to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about international trade. Speaking of beef and speaking of commodity crops, we send, as you pointed out earlier when we were talking about fish, we send a lot of food overseas. There's a lot of, the Chinese are buying a lot of beef from us, and they're buying a lot of other products from us. And I think that, you know, are we going to be selling to other countries at the expense of our own food security, do you think? And is that already happening?
Well, one thing I should say is that a lot of the nut production is being driven by demand from China.
That's right, yeah.
Some huge portion of the, you know, California grows something like 90% of the world's almonds. I mean,
right.
Globally. Similar things with pistachios, walnuts. And a big part of this boom that we're seeing, this dramatic expansion, is for the China market.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I think it is, I mean, I think, like with climate change, there's no real progress. We eventually need a global deal on climate. We need a global carbon deal. And I think that the only way you're going to get that is if the U.S. acts first, because we, you know, we're the country, along with Europe, that really benefited from the fossil fuel boom.
Indeed.
And caused, you know, most of the problems that we're going to have are already baked in from our emissions.
Right.
So I think we've got to act first. And I think the same is true for food, in that we're going to need a global deal that, you know, basically gets people to eat a little bit lower on the food chain. And that means, you know, we need to eat less meat.
And more
and
crickets.
Other places where they don't eat so much meat, they can grow their meat consumption, but you know, not to the level that the U.S. has it right now or Europe has it right now.
Right.
But you know, to answer your question, yeah, I am worried that global trade flows are going to drive a lot of agricultural change here in the United States in ways that we can't control. I mean, you know, the biggest pork producing company got bought by China.
Indeed, and, I do know that.
Last year. Mm-hmm. And that whole play is an export to China play.
Yeah.
And, you know, the China food market has been complicated because the regime there has wanted to have a self-sufficient food policy. And they've had a really dramatic agricultural miracle in the past generation or two.
Right.
But, you know, basically, I think their agricultural miracle is tapped out. It can't expand anymore, really. I mean, there's some marginal things that can happen. But they have realized that they have to, you know, start importing a lot. And they're actually not importing their beef right now. Most of their beef imports come from Australia.
Huh.
They put a ban on U.S. beef in 2003 over a mad cow here, and they haven't taken it off.
I didn't realize that.
There's a lot of speculation. Lots of speculation that it's going to come off as soon as this year.
Yeah, I've heard that. You know, absolutely. In fact, I thought they were buying from us again.
Yeah, and they're huge importers of our pork
and chicken,
and they're chicken and really big importers of chicken, and what they're really massively importing is seed. So, you know, huge and growing amounts of our corn and soy are going to China.
Right.
As is the, you know, the consumption of Brazil. And so, you know, as we're talking about how we need to change our agriculture because of climate change and the inability of the farm bill to kind of do anything about it, there are these global market forces that are also keeping our current system in place.
Yes.
You know, that is, you know, China basically provides the price, you know, provides a their demand provides a price floor for corn and soy,
mm-hmm.
that is going to keep that machine pumping for a while, I think.
Yeah, I think that is true also. I was, just as an aside, again, to refer to my trip to Vietnam, I was amazed at how much corn they're planting. Like, that really caught me by surprise. But they have a lot of corn going on there. And it's partly to feed livestock. I'm sorry, what?
I would assume it's mostly for feed, right?
It's mostly for feed, but they're eating corn too, and they don't really like it. But in case of, you know, like a low rice yield or something like that, it's a fallback staple for them.
Yeah.
It was interesting to me.
People don't realize that after the United States, China is the second biggest producer of corn.
Mm.
And, you know, they basically dramatically expanded their own corn production for livestock seed.
Yeah.
But they've, you know, and they kept out U.S. If you look at the China corn imports to the United States, it's basically zero, and then it explodes in 2009.
Huh, interesting.
And it has been at this heightened level ever since. And that reflects a conscious decision. Okay, we can't keep up with demand for corn in our livestock sector. We need to go to the big corn bank, which is U.S.
That's right. So well, also they run out of the Chinese have a limited amount of arable land, right? Because they do not have the great wide open spaces that the United States is so blessed with, and so for them, you know, they can't just monocrop with, you know, thousands or millions of acres of corn or soy. And that's why they've bought so much land in Brazil as well to grow soy, right? Or Argentina.
Yeah. And also Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, their arable land per capita, I'm not looking at the numbers right now, but I've written about it. It's a fraction of ours.
Yeah.
It's something like a quarter of ours.
And yet their population is many times ours. So
yeah.
They have a real food security issue.
20% of their farmland, they just came out with a report. This is one of those things that has been known for. The report came out a while back, and the government tried to repress it, and it just kind of released a report about a month ago that found that about a fifth of its farmland is really badly polluted from both industrial waste and also from overapplication of fertilizer.
Yeah.
So you got a fifth of farmland there degraded, and then you overlay that with that they've got very little arable land per person.
Right.
And you're looking at a monstrous food importer going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And their population is not diminishing particularly. Although I don't think it's growing. It's certainly not growing the way the Middle East is. I mean, because the Chinese limit how many children you can have, as they do in Vietnam and most of the Asian countries, apparently.
Yeah. So their population isn't going to expand dramatically, but it's already huge.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, the rise in consumption of meat just makes it more and more resource intensive as time goes on.
Yeah, it's stunning. Well, we're going to talk about this some more, but I wanted to just read this quote that I read. I think it was in The Guardian, just because I loved it so much. But apparently, under an act of Congress, the reports, and we're talking about the National Climate Assessment Report, the reports were supposed to be produced every 4 years, but no report was produced during George W. Bush's presidency. And I just said, oh my God, duh, of course he wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, it's a kind of don't ask, don't tell policy.
I'll say. Guys, like, you know, totally into the fossil fuel. And you can imagine that Mr. Cheney had something to do with that as well. I mean, yeah, sure. Let's put another black mark on the Bush presidency. I mean, it's almost like, it's like there couldn't have been a worse person to run this country for 8 years. Like, he did so much damage, especially in this sector of, like, not focusing on energy alternatives and not bringing any attention to agriculture. And it's just like we lost so much ground in that 10 years, basically. It just breaks my heart to think about it.
And if you know, one thing that I just started to write about this stuff in a big way in the middle of that presidency. Uh-huh. And one thing that I just found stunning was that when Bush finally acknowledged that climate change might be a problem and that, you know, our reliance on oil might be a problem, his only policy response was ethanol.
That's right.
You know, he dramatically ramped up ethanol. Now it's like his big sort of concession to climate change, and it was supposed to be challenging the oil industry by accepting this alternative fuel.
Yeah.
And
all it did was challenge farmers.
If you deep into it, that was a bad joke.
It was a desperate thing to do.
Change.
And you know very well, as a farm owner yourself, I mean, corn prices went up to like $9 a bushel from $2.
Right.
You know, before that. And it's taken years and years to stabilize that corn market and get the prices back to a place where the average small-sized farmer, mid-sized farmer can actually afford corn themselves.
Right.
I mean, it was like, it was staggering what was going on. And just to keep the ethanol game going, you know, it's like, I got to know who was making money on that. Somebody in particular really, really cashed in. So
ADM is a good example.
Right. And wait, ADM? What is that? Oh, Archer Daniels Midland. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. They would be the ones. So anyway, and the last thing I wanted to bring up before we close, which we have to do in a couple minutes, is did you see that there is a big run on fracking rights in New Mexico right now? Have you followed that at all? There's like all these leases are being...
I have looked at that, and, you know, I'm down here in Texas nowadays, and
are?
Very similar, you know, similar geography,
just
east of there, you know, Texas is doing massive fracking, and I already know the question you're going to ask, and that is, where in the hell was the water coming from?
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know. I mean, that is a really good question, because water is so scarce in West Texas and South Texas and New Mexico.
They have entire towns that are out of water, literally don't have water, right?
Yeah, and to bring a conversation full circle back to California, you know, there's massive oil deposits in the Monterey Shale, which is in the Central Valley, and there's a push to frack. There's a major push afoot to frack that land, and we were just talking about how are we going to, you know, without fracking, how are we going to keep farming going in California? What changes have to be made? And you had another massive, you know, both consumer of water and fouler of water in the middle of an agriculture zone. How does that work?
I don't know.
And I honestly don't know. It's crazy.
It's really crazy. And, it seems very wrong that there isn't some sort of national referendum on these policies, that we just seem to, like, sell off this stuff to the highest bidder without any, you know, consideration for the public or the consumer. You know, we'll be paying much higher food prices in the future thanks to all of this activity, because we'll be importing our own food. We won't be making food for export anymore. We'll be importing it like the Chinese have to. I mean, it's going to be a joke.
And I've looked pretty closely at that, and I just don't see where, you know, I don't see where this other place that we're going to import it from is. I mean, these markets are already, you know, I guess my quick, because I did another Mother Jones column on, you know, what happens if California runs out of water, And I think, you know, one thing that, one little bit of hope is that in the Midwest, in the Corn Belt, I'm not saying that, you know, you're talking about, you know, I don't know, 130, 140, 150 million acres, and that's not going to be converted to vegetables, obviously, in the Corn Belt. But you could convert some of it, some, you know, rather small percentage of it in the greater scheme of things, and do very, very good vegetable, fruit and vegetable production. You know, it's never going to be California because it doesn't have, you know, it's not sunny and warm year-round. But in the growing season, you could get significant fruit and vegetable production. And, you know, some of the crops could be, you know, things like apples that they keep for a while.
Sure, apples, potatoes, turnips, all the root vegetables, all of that stuff.
Stuff that can be processed into canned tomatoes. You know, California is the leader in, you know, basically U.S. canned tomato production happens in California.
Right.
You could get a significant boost in vegetable production in the Midwest. You know, since the price of corn went down and stabilized, you know, somewhere between $4 and $5, there was that Michael Moss article in the New York Times a few months ago about how farmers are experimenting, as they were before ethanol. They're experimenting in, you know, let's take 20 acres of our, you know, 2,000, 5,000 acre farm and put in a few vegetables and see what happens.
Right.
And that is the kind of thing that I think could partially offset the, you know, what I think is the inevitable, you know, at least decline of fruit and vegetable production in California.
Yeah.
Is re-regionalize it. And in places like the Midwest, where they have huge amounts of rich soil and they've got a pretty good, you know, relatively speaking, pretty good water situation, I think vegetable production could boost up there.
And well, I imagine vegetables can't be as water intensive as some of these other monocrops, right?
Right. No, exactly right. And you know, there's this fallow thing where you could fallow in some years. You know, some of it. It's more flexible.
Well, there was a big study at Iowa State about that, about rotating out, you know, your crops, you know, on a three crop, you know, a three crop rotation instead of the two crop rotation, and how much better that would be for the soil. Unfortunately, Tom, we got to wrap it up here. But you'll be back in a few weeks. And what are you doing in Texas, by the way? Why are you down there?
I grew up here, and my family is from here, and I am.
Oh yeah,
back
we called
here
your mom by mistake this morning.
Say again.
We called your mom by mistake this morning. She said, "You don't live here anymore."
Well, yeah, I'm down here to be closer to my family for family reasons.
Very good. All right, my darling, thank you so much for this, Tom. Again, as always, a great conversation, and I look forward to the next one. We'll be talking soon. Take care of yourself.
Always great talking to you.
Thank you. Take care, Katie. Take care. Bye-bye. And thanks to my sponsor, Kane Winery, and to my engineer, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next week for another great show. Enjoy the week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.